Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media, we begin a two-part look at the education funding lawsuit before the Court of Chancery, starting with the portion of that suit demanding counties update decades-old property assessments.
If you ask anyone associated with the county defendants in this case whether a property assessment conducted 40 years ago is going to reflect a property's fair market value today, they're going to politely refuse to answer the question.
Contributor Larry Nagengast delves into this controversial debate over assessments. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear about federal funding coming to the Delaware River Basin for conservation projects, and a NASCAR legend coming to Georgetown next month. Plus, we bring you some great student work being produced at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School with help from our Generation Voice Youth Media Program. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The issue of education funding in the first state has moved from back burner to front. One catalyst for that move, a lawsuit filed in January 2018 by Delawareans for Educational Opportunity and the NAACP Delaware State Conference of Branches, with legal support from the ACLU Foundation of Delaware and the Community Legal Aid Society. That suit is challenging Delaware's system of funding public education in the Court of Chancery, contending that inequities in the funding system impair the opportunity of disadvantaged students to receive an adequate education. The plaintiffs also argue the current system for levying property taxes at the county level contributes to the problem because it violates long-established standards set by the Delaware General Assembly. Over the next 2 weeks, contributor Larry Nagengast is examining the key issues in this case for us and will join us here on The Green. His first piece on assessments and property taxes is online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And Larry sat down with me earlier this week to discuss this portion of the issue.
Well, let's start with giving people a quick primer on where we stand right now with assessments. We hear that these assessments are outdated. What does that exactly mean?
It's complicated, so I'll try to keep it simple. If you go back to the 19th century, you'll find that Delaware's laws called for periodic assessments of real property. And in some instances, there were actually specified time intervals for doing so, like every 8 or 10 years. Suffice to say that the counties got away from that practice. They got away from it so much that the last assessment that was done in Kent County was in 1987. And in Newcastle County, even longer, 1983. And in Sussex County, you've got to go back 45 years to 1974, to the time of the last property reassessment. Now, property values change from year to year, and over time, the differences can be significant in different parts of each county. Let me give you a purely hypothetical example. I'll try to use two towns in Sussex County. You take two similar homes, let's say one's in Milford and one is in Seaford, and they both would have been assessed at about $30,000 in 1974. Now today, the house in Milton is probably worth much more than the one in Seaford, if only because of Milton's proximity to the coast and to the softer economic conditions in western Sussex. But the assessed value of these properties is the same, so their owners are still paying the same amount in county taxes, even though what the house would go for on the market is significantly different.
Having said that, has the fact that these assessments are so outdated affect school funding?
Okay, another good question. And I'm really not sure that I'm going to give you a good answer here, but let's start with this. The state law does require that assessed value must reflect what is known as the property's, quote, true value in money, close quote. And the Delaware Supreme Court has held that this concept equates to the property's fair market value. Now, if you ask anyone associated with the county defendants in this case whether a property assessment conducted 40 years ago is going to reflect a property's fair market value today, they're going to politely refuse to answer the question. Now, if you ask anyone who's familiar with real estate markets, they'll tell you that there's no way that a 40-year-old assessment can be meaningful today. In other words, over time, assessment numbers get more and more out of whack, making the system less fair both to taxpayers and to the school districts. If you do a reassessment, there'll be some who benefit and some who don't make out as well. I'm talking about both school districts and taxpayers. But there's another underlying issue here. When you don't reassess for decades, the tax base remains essentially the same, but school costs go up, and that forces school districts to hold referendums every 3 to 5 years because they've got to raise tax rates in order to pay their bills. If assessments more closely reflected property values, the argument goes, school districts might be able to enact smaller tax hikes without the need for frequent referendums, which, by the way, whether the districts win or lose, do cost quite a bit of money for them to conduct.
So let's dig in here a little bit to the actual suit itself. The judge hearing the case, Chancery Court Vice Chancellor Travis Laster, has split it into two parts, and this assessment piece is one of those two parts. He's already shot down a number of efforts by the defendants in that piece, the counties, to dismiss it. What have we learned from what Laster has ruled so far?
Well, as you say, he's split the case into two parts. The section that deals with the state funding, the money that the General Assembly appropriates for public education and how that's allocated, will be heard separately from the county assessment portion. And the county portion is going to be heard first. Now, in his first ruling on the assessment matter, this was in October, the vice chancellor rejected a series of technical claims made by the counties. Arguments along the lines of, well, this case shouldn't have been filed in the court of chancery, or the plaintiffs had other remedies available to them, or the county tax collector shouldn't have been named as defendants. Now, Laster did note that it was proper for the county officials to be named as defendants, even if they haven't done anything wrong, because they are required to collect property taxes on behalf of the school districts. But in terms of the, you know, the substance of the case, there were no clear rulings, although, you know, Laster did certainly acknowledge that he believes there's a lot of validity to the complaints that the plaintiffs put into the suit.
So let's move a little bit further and ask, you know, where does that leave us regarding what will be argued once this case actually reaches the courtroom? Let's start with the plaintiffs. What are they saying here in this suit?
Another good question, Tom, because before the case goes to trial, we go to that phase that's called discovery, when the plaintiffs ask the defendants for all sorts of documents about the issues in the case. And here's where we'll get to the matter of whether 40-year-old assessments can reflect today's market values. County officials can say no comment to a reporter, but I suspect they'll have a difficult time supporting that position when they're testifying under oath. Now, in that respect, it's about fairness, whether the current numbers are fair to the school districts and to taxpayers alike. And as I indicated earlier about the long intervals between reassessments, it's about putting a more sensible system in place. In every other state, reassessments are conducted periodically and far more frequently than in Delaware. Dare I say that, literally and figuratively, this case is truly about bringing Delaware's assessment practices into the 21st century.
But now the counties argue it's not quite as simple as that, as the plaintiffs suggest. In your piece, they say reassessment may not deliver what proponents expect, in part because of the cost of actually doing it. Can you explain what that means?
Well, okay, there are two separate laws in play that impact the amount of tax revenue that can be generated through a reassessment. In the year after a reassessment, school districts are allowed to set a tax rate that would bring in revenue that is no more than 10% greater than what it collected in property taxes in the year before the reassessment. Now, that sounds like a windfall for the schools, but it's not quite as much as you might think. So you see, property taxes do account for less than a third of school district revenues. Most of their money comes from the state. So that really amounts to about a 3% increase in a district's overall budget if they raise taxes by that maximum of 10%. Now, as for the counties, they are allowed to raise taxes by 15% when a reassessment occurs, but then they have to roll back the rate the following year, so they only collect as much money in property taxes as they did in the year before reassessment. So that 15% bump is essentially a fee that pays for the reassessment. Hey, there might be a little bit left over, but still, that's essentially what it does. So this reality also helps explain why counties don't want to have a reassessment. They've got to ask the taxpayers to pay for it, but there's no real payoff for them in terms of increased revenue that could mean improved services, whatever, down the road.
But the plaintiffs do argue, and Laster seems to agree, that there is an argument for the districts, whatever the issues are with reassessment. They are not as large as the issues that districts face going to referendum as often as they do. What's the case they're making here in terms of, you know, doing reassessment versus this, as I think you kind of alluded to earlier, constantly having to go to referendum?
Well, I think the best way to do this is to give you a paragraph directly from Vice Chancellor Laster's opinion. Here you go. Frequent tax referendums generate negative reactions. Some residents object as a matter of principle to having their taxes raised. More object if they think their tax dollars are not being used wisely. Delaware's complex system for funding public schools is not easily understood. Confronted with regular requests for tax increases, some residents naturally infer that school officials are wasting money, and community resentment does not help the public schools or disadvantaged students.
So in some ways, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation for the counties and the districts, that reassessment could help or maybe not. And certainly referendums can help, but are difficult. It is kind of a difficult spot that they've been put in.
Most definitely. And this plays into the way a lot of residents feel about taxes and about the reassessment issue. And I'd like to bring up what is really the conventional wisdom here. I talked with Ed Ratledge, who's a University of Delaware government and demographics expert, who has been following this issue for more than 40 years. And the conventional wisdom here is that reassessment splits properties into three distinct and roughly equal categories. One group sees its tax bills significantly lowered. One group sees its tax bills remain pretty much the same, and one sees what could be fairly significant tax increases because their properties had been underassessed many, many years ago. Now, by that reckoning, though, two-thirds of the taxpayers make out pretty much okay. Those who see their bills lowered or those that have them stay about the same. However, Ratledge notes, property owners are notorious in thinking that their home is worth a lot more than it really is. So with that mindset, they're afraid that the reassessment is going to put their property into that one-third that sees the biggest increase.
So perhaps there's the argument here that if people are scared of reassessment, but once it happens, they would perhaps see, the most people would, perhaps see that it's not as bad as having to go to referendum all the time.
I think you're definitely right about that. Although, you know, there are other factors that go into the referendum issue. No matter what you're doing, no matter how you reassess, the district's costs are going to continue to go up. There are some solutions to that, but the issue here is goes beyond the homeowners. I think if you look also, commercial and industrial properties are a bigger problem than residential properties when you're looking at reassessment. You know, you can appeal a reassessment if you don't like what the value is. And what's happened lately is that large commercial and industrial property owners have taken to going to county governments, particularly after the use of that property has changed, and they go and they ask for a reassessment. Now, you know, if you're a homeowner, you're not going to spend $1,000 with a lawyer to hopefully save $100 on your tax bill. If you're a big property owner, different story. You can save thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, paying a lawyer is very much worth it. So you take an example. Brandywine School District, they've lost about $2 million a year in tax revenue because of successful appeals to Newcastle County by the owners of the AstraZeneca property, the old steel mill in Tri-State Mall in Claymont, and the old Edgemore titanium dioxide plant that DuPont Company used to own. Christina School District, they're losing $200,000 a year since the county reduced the assessed value of the DuPont building in downtown Wilmington.
So that's one issue. You brought up some other issues as well in your piece. And one of them is the brewing tension between Newcastle County and the city of Wilmington over reassessment that's kind of just surfaced as kind of an undercurrent of this whole lawsuit. What's going on there?
You know, Wilmington Mayor Mike Przycki fired the first salvo in this dispute last year when he complained that the county's actions on assessment appeals, as with the DuPont building revaluation that I just mentioned, is costing the city tax revenues and threatening its financial stability. And it seems that Wilmington took the county somewhat by surprise last month when it filed a motion to intervene in the school funding suit. not because of any education-related concerns, but because of the property assessment matter. In this respect, Wilmington is much like the school districts because it relies on the county assessments, and it gets hurt when the county lowers the valuations of properties within the city limits. County Executive Matt Meyer says Wilmington ought to just go and conduct its own assessments if it wants to, just like Dover and Rehoboth do. But Wilmington says it can't because the wording in the city's own code requires that it uses the county's assessment. It's an interesting side issue that adds one more layer of complexity to this case.
But looking ahead, what happens next will largely depend on how this court case is resolved. But is there a sense of where we go from here, some possible paths forward that could make reassessment happen while answering some of these issues that we've talked about here?
Well, let's first circle back to where we started with this discussion. The plaintiff's lawyers think that the assessment part of the case could be resolved in Chancery by the end of this year, with the state funding portion being resolved by sometime late next year. Then appeals could be filed to the state Supreme Court, probably first on the assessment issue and then later on when the state funding issue is resolved. But the state Supreme Court is as far as the case will go because there are no federal issues here. You know, this is one, you know, you can't make a federal case out of this lawsuit. As for the possible outcomes, don't count on the counties or the General Assembly to resolve this on their own. The politicians would rather say, we don't want to pay for this reassessment, but the judge made us do it. You know, based on the facts that I've seen so far, I don't see how the counties can successfully defend the existing assessments. So the real question is what the judge will order. The plaintiffs have suggested one draconian solution, that the judge order the counties not to collect any taxes until a new assessment system is in place. Wow, talk about a government shutdown there. Now, more realistically, the judge could set a deadline for the counties to come up with a plan for reassessment or a deadline for a reassessment to be completed and then maintain jurisdiction over the case to make sure that the counties comply.
And I guess ultimately there are some examples elsewhere that a reassessment here could follow, not just immediately, but ongoing.
Well, 2 years ago, Newcastle County officials were actually taking a look into reassessment and the possible costs and how long it might take and so on. And at the time, they pointed to Maryland as an example. In Maryland, they do what's called a rolling reassessment over a 3-year cycle. So in each year in this cycle, 1/3 of the properties in the state are reassessed. And then if the value of a property is increased through the reassessment, any increase in taxes on that property are phased in over a period of 3 years. So the homeowner, the property owner, doesn't feel the full bump of that assessment increase in one bite, but rather it's spread out over 3 years. Now, one other point here, this comes from Ed Ratledge at University of Delaware. He points out that since the counties only receive about 1/3 of the property tax revenue, and that's a real reason why they're not interested in conducting this reassessment and having to get a tax increase to do it, he suggests using state revenue bonds to pay for the reassessment, and that moving forward, the state maintain a database of property values that all three counties could use, and on any local governments as well, for reassessment purposes. You know, those are just a couple of ideas that are out there. Now, regardless, I think it's fairly likely that something new is going to be developed when this case is settled. And, you know, as Ryan Tack Hooper, who's the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, puts it, given how badly things are out of whack now, almost any reasonable effort is going to be more fair than what we have today.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. Again, part one of his examination of the issues in the lawsuit over state funding of schools is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And join us next week for part two, which looks more closely at the actual system used by Delaware to deliver public school funding. And The Green continues in just a moment with more on new federal funding for conservation projects in the Delaware River Basin. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware River Basin Restoration Program recently received $6 million in federal funding when President Trump signed legislation keeping the government open through September. The program first received federal support a year ago when it received $5 million. Sandra Miola is director of the Coalition for the Delaware River Watershed and the New Jersey Audubon, which also applied for funding. Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller recently spoke with Miola about the restoration program, environmental challenges in the watershed, and new projects expected to be announced next month.
Can you start off just by talking about the $6 million and what it'll go towards?
Sure. So the Coalition celebrated the success of the Delaware River Basin Restoration Program, which was appropriated $5 million for fiscal year 18 through an omnibus spending bill. And this past week, with the president signing the FY19 omnibus spending bill package, we saw that there was $6 million for fiscal year 19. So this is really great news, and it's just showcasing the success and work of all of the coalition partners and congressional members. It's really showcasing the dedication to natural resources within the watershed and clean water.
Is there a match to this federal funding?
There has to be a one-to-one match. The organization or municipality or entity applying must have a one-to-one match. It could be a mixture of federal or non-federal money, but NFWF prefers, a non-federal match for a one-to-one.
So does that mean that your organization has to come up with, $6
million? No. So the coalition, the coalition directly isn't receiving this money. So some of our coalition members are going to be receiving grants who've applied. For example, New Jersey Audubon, applied and is going to receive grant funding. So they had to come up, that applicant needed to come up with a match.
The Delaware River Basin, I know that it encompasses four states.
The Delaware River Watershed is a four-state region, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Delaware obviously being the smallest state, and Delaware is where the river empties out into the Delaware Bay and then into the Atlantic Ocean.
And can you talk about some of the species that are in the Delaware River?
So the Delaware River Watershed supports hundreds of wildlife species, about 200 species of migratory birds, including the red knot, which loves to hang out in the Delaware Bay along Delaware's coast, and they eat horseshoe crab eggs. So the Delaware Bay specifically is home to nation's largest population of American horseshoe crabs, which is pretty cool. So these birds, the red knots, they fly, hundreds of thousands of miles to, eat these eggs, the horseshoe crab eggs, and then they continue onward with their migratory pattern. The watershed is also home to several endangered fish species, such as the Atlantic sturgeon, bald eagle, of course, the popular species for folks to see. So, it's a really diverse, but also deserving of protection given all of the endangered wildlife within the region. So it was really exciting to see an increase in funding. I can talk a little bit about where exactly the funding will go to, if you'd like. The $6 million is appropriated to the Delaware River Basin Restoration Program. This is a program that's kind of facilitated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So Fish and Wildlife Service kind of flows money to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and those two partners established a grant program titled the Delaware Watershed Conservation Fund. So this past fall, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Fish and Wildlife Foundation issued an RFP for grant proposals. So, nonprofit groups, government agencies, municipalities all submitted projects for this fund to be funded. NFWF is soon going to release the list of grantees. So it's really exciting to see, this first round of funding is going to be out the door really soon. And now we have even more money to work with for a second and third round of projects to be funded. And these projects specifically are aimed to restore and conserve wildlife habitat, protect against flooding, stream erosion, and really tackle some of the problems that the Delaware River watershed faces, like overdevelopment, habitat loss, polluted stormwater runoff. So really exciting to see this investment, and I really hope that it continues to grow year over year.
the river basin? What kind of shape is it in? How healthy is it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the Delaware River Basin has come a long way, you know, but it still faces, like I said, you know, polluted stormwater runoff, raw sewage being, you know, discharged into your local waterways, especially near the urban areas of Philly and Wilmington and Camden in New Jersey. You know, I think it's a matter of controlling what's going into the water from the roads. And we have agricultural runoff in the more rural areas like Delaware and upper New York State. So, yeah, I mean, in general, I think it's, you know, it's come a long way, but that's not to say there's still a lot of work to be done. You know, one of the biggest, you know, the Delaware River watershed is a vital resource because it supplies about 15 million people with clean drinking water. So that's, you know, it's a fifth of the population of the country, extremely worthy of the attention that it's getting now. And I hope that that attention and those resources allocated to the watershed continue.
What kind of projects are they?
So I can't say too much about the project because they aren't publicly released yet. National Fish and Wildlife Service is planning to do a public press event probably in mid-March. So I do know what the projects are, but I'm not really supposed to disclose them before the projects get in front. But I will say that they're, you know, a few of them are stormwater management projects, like green infrastructure projects. A few of them are habitat restoration projects. And a few other ones are research projects. It's really exciting for everyone. I mean, this is first time. I mean, last year was first time historic funding for the watershed ever. And this time it's, you know, it's more money. And it's exciting to keep seeing this program grow and grow. And I hope that it's going to be something that continues to grow and be equivalent to some of the other programs throughout the country, like the Chesapeake Bay Watershed has a program that, you know, is appropriated for millions of dollars, you know, much more than ours. Same with the Great Lakes, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's really great to see that, you know, this resource is worthy of attention and getting these resources.
Thanks to Chandra Miola of the Coalition for the Delaware River Watershed and our Sarah Mueller for their time this week. The Green continues next with more on a NASCAR legend coming to Georgetown next month. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. A famous face from NASCAR's past is coming to Georgetown next month. NASCAR racing great Bobby Allison is set to serve as Grand Marshal for the annual Melvin J. Joseph Memorial Weekend at Georgetown Speedway, March 15th and 16th. Melvin Joseph, who built the Georgetown Speedway, as well as Dover International Speedway, will be honored again prior to Saturday's 2019 Short Track Super Series opener at the Georgetown track. The former NASCAR owner first met Allison in 1971 when Allison opted to drive Joseph's Ford Mustang in a race in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Allison, the 1983 NASCAR Cup Series champion, and Joseph remained friends until Joseph died in 2005. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele recently spoke with Georgetown Speedway promoter Brett Deo about the event, the track's history, and about Bobby Allison's friendship with Melvin Joseph.
Pretty exciting. Each year we open our season by honoring Melvin Joseph, who actually built the Speedway back in 1949. And he also was the principal in the construction of Dover and actually worked as a head of Dover International Speedway through 2005 when he passed away. But, you know, each year we try and do something to honor Melvin, and one of his closest friends and actually a former driver of his when he had a NASCAR team, Bobby Allison, is coming in to do the Grand Marshal duties this year. And it's something that we really wanted to do because, you know, Bobby Allison and Melvin were very close, and it means a lot to his family and to everybody to have him there and be part of our event. And it's a great, you know, exciting thing for the fans because, you know, he's one of the best, you know, top five in the all-time win list for the NASCAR's top levels. And to have him there and meet and greet with the fans at a local dirt track is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, give me some background about Bobby Allison. For people who are not NASCAR fans, a lot of people here in Delaware are, but give me some background other than what you've already said about Bobby Allison.
Bobby has 84 career wins in NASCAR's top level, which is you know, not far below many of the, you know, the highest winners, you know, Richard Petty and Pearson and those types. He was a 7-time most popular driver in NASCAR. So that says a little bit about, you know, how he resonated with the fans. And you know, one of his more memorable things was a race he didn't win, 1979, the Daytona 500, that kind of sparked the popularity of NASCAR. It was Donnie Allison and Cale Yarbrough crashed coming to the checkered flag, and then there was a big fight afterwards on national television, and Bobby was involved in that. But that was something that, you know, is always kind of remembered. He had the Daytona 500. He won 3 times. The Southern 500 at Darlington, he won 4 times. The 600 at Charlotte, he won 2 times. 1983, Winston Cup Series champion. So, I mean, he's done it all. And, you know, after he retired, he went on to own race teams for a while in NASCAR. And, you know, he still loves to be involved in racing. And you'll see him, you know, at a lot of the NASCAR races, you'll see him out and around because he still loves the sport. And, you know, it's an honor for us to have somebody with that list of accomplishments, you know, in the NASCAR Hall of Fame, being at Georgetown to meet our fans and interact with everybody.
All right, so NASCAR legend Bobby Allison coming to the Georgetown Speedway, which is a half-mile oval on Saturday, March the 16th. And what exactly is he going to be doing?
He'll actually have a full hour interacting with fans, signing autographs. And then prior to the start of our racing, we're also going to have him speak to the crowd and kind of share some of his memories of racing with Melvin Joseph. So we'll get to see both sides of it. You know, we'll get to hear some of his thoughts and memories, and then, you know, fans can have a full hour of one-on-one time where they can talk to him, get autographs, you know, pose for pictures. So it'll be a little bit of both sides, and that's something that, you know, we're really looking forward to, as we are offering that opportunity for our fans to get up close and personal.
Man, that sounds like it's going to be a great time. Give me some background about the Georgetown Speedway.
The Speedway is a half-mile clay oval. We have seating for just over 2,500 fans. Our food there is supplied by Fat Daddy's Barbecue, which a lot of people in the Georgetown area know. We've got delicious food. We have free parking. We have adult, senior, student, kid pricing, so it's affordable for the family. We have a series of special events throughout the summer. We start in March and we race through November, but we have select dates with big events. You know, we have wingless sprint cars. We have super late models. We have a 2-day monster truck show in July. We try and mix it up and keep it interesting because we are an entertainment venue, just like anything in the area and on the beaches. So we try and keep our shows quick, entertaining, family fun. And, you know, the Speedway has a tremendous amount of history. It opened in 1950. And last year we were fortunate enough to get a historical marker out front from the state of Delaware, recognizing the history and the contribution to the state as an entertainment venue. So Georgetown Speedway has a lot of history. And, you know, the last few years, this is my 4th year as a promoter there. We've taken on a lot of improvement projects with lighting and facilities and new novelty stands, ticket booths, renovating the concession, you know, new clay, banking the track. There's a lot of things that we've done in the last 4 years to bring it up to modern standards. But we don't like to let go of the history either, because that's a big part of it.
Any other big names over the years? Now Bobby Allison, but any other big names that have graced the track at Georgetown Speedway?
Oh, absolutely. You know, in its earlier years, in the mid 50s and early 60s, it was a NASCAR sanctioned track. So you had all the big names of the time coming through Georgetown and competing in these events. And, you know, AJ Foyt comes to mind. And, you know, it's just it's hosted some of the biggest names in racing over its time. And now, you know, with our configuration of higher paying races and special events, we're getting the best drivers of our time, you know, to come down and compete. You know, a couple of years ago, Stuart Friesen ran in the NASCAR truck race at Dover during the day, came down and raced with us, and actually won at night on the dirt track. So we're starting to rebuild that, you know, that lore of Georgetown Speedway being one of the Northeast top facilities. And, you know, it's only upward from here because of our, you know, Delaware has a great group of race fans. One of the things that I enjoy most as a promoter is seeing the race fans have fun. And, you know, on a Friday afternoon in the summer when everybody's tailgating in the parking lot and having a good time, that means a lot to me. It's just like, you know, having a party at your house. You want everyone to have a good time. And we've got that there.
Anything else that I'm leaving out, Brett, that you want the fans to know about?
If you haven't tried it and you haven't been to a dirt track race, I encourage everyone to come out. Last year, we did a monster truck show for 2 days, which we're doing again this year, and we brought in a lot of new fans that hadn't been to our facility, and a lot of them came back. You know, they came back for our stock car races after that date, and they found that it was a fun and affordable night out, and like I said, it's free parking. We have all kinds of great food, but you can also bring food and beverages in. We have affordable prices. We have discounts for students, seniors, children, all of that. So it is an affordable night out. And, you know, if you have time on a Friday night or a special event during the summer, come on out and check us out.
Thanks to Georgetown Speedway promoter Brett Deo and R. Kelly Steele for their time on the green this week. Again, Bobby Allison will be at Georgetown Speedway for the Melvin J. Joseph Memorial Saturday, March 16th, and will meet and greet fans in the grandstand between 3 and 4 ahead of Saturday's racing, which starts at 5. More information is available at thegeorgetownspeedway.com. And we wrap up the green next with Enlighten Me, which this week highlights some student work at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, part of our Generation Voice Youth Media Partnership there, and at WMHS in the Red Clay School District. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we return to WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, one of the two schools we've partnered with on our Generation Voice Youth Media Program. Students there and at our other partner, WMHS, at McCain High School in the Red Clay School District, produce a bevy of interviews and projects on a variety of topics throughout the year. And from time to time, we'd like to highlight some of that work right here on The Green. This week, we share with you a pair of thoughtful features produced at Mount Pleasant's WMPH. The first is from junior Sean Coulter. The CDC reports that cigarette usage among middle and high schoolers has decreased in recent years, but e-cigarette usage has increased. So Sean delved into the danger presented by a specific brand of e-cigarette, the Juul, which has gained popularity at high schools like Mount Pleasant.
The health risks of cigarettes are widely known throughout American society, thanks in part to education campaigns throughout the 1940s and 2000s.
Then she lights his cigarette and he's all set. Set with a lifestyle that could lead to a heart attack. Ask your heart association how to reduce your risk of heart attack.
Cigarettes are bullies. Don't let tobacco control you.
But now, there is a supposedly safer way to enjoy your nicotine, in the form of a device that looks like a USB drive. These small electronic vape tools are called Juuls. Mount Pleasant junior Aaliyah says she thinks they're safer than cigarettes.
Probably better in a way, because although it has all those chemicals and stuff, cigarettes can, kill you faster.
But how safe are they? According to the Truth Initiative, one Juul pod contains 20 cigarettes worth of nicotine, and a pod only lasts the average Juuler 2 to 4 days. Juuls contain more than twice the amount of nicotine as other e-cigarettes, according to HealthyChildren.org. Nicotine is a highly addictive substance and can be especially dangerous to developing youth. I talked to a professional, Dr. Mark Felizzi, to see how true these statements really were.
Mark Felizzi, I'm an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Millersville University. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, and I hold a PhD in social work. Juuls tend to have a higher rate of nicotine. As a matter of fact, Juul pod has enough nicotine in it, has the same amount of nicotine as 20 cigarettes. So when you're taking a hit on a Juul, you're basically sucking in 20 cigarettes or a pack of cigarettes worth of nicotine.
Just like Aaliyah, many youth believe that Juuls are a safer alternative to cigarettes because it contains less toxic chemicals when, in reality, they can be just as dangerous.
Well, if you look at the fact that cigarette smoking in this country has decreased largely in part to education efforts. I think that Juuls are marketed and Juuls are viewed as something that's less addictive and less dangerous than traditional smoking. It's not always the case because you're getting a more pure form of nicotine.
While some believe the only harm in Juuls is addiction, Juuls also affect a lot of bodily functions. Nicotine has been proven to be harmful to brain development as well as being a highly addictive substance.
It affects the lungs, it affects the heart, it affects circulation. But also, since the human brain really isn't fully developed until the age 20, until the age of 25, with teens, specifically middle and high school students, you're looking at nicotine potentially affecting brain development.
Some of the misconception among teens might come from the industry's advertising. A study verified in the 2016 Surgeon General's report, e-cigarette use among youth and young adults, showed that 95% of Juul advertisements made explicit or implicit health-related claims, and some ads even featured doctors. Nearly all of the ads characterize e-cigarettes as cleaner and cheaper than traditional cigarettes.
And the counter-argument to that is, well, you know, a cigarette has formaldehyde, it has tar in it, it has other properties, you know, so yeah, that's true, but also in cigarettes, which are not healthy, obviously, they have a less concentrated form of nicotine. So I do believe that a lot of people, and the way it's been marketed, especially to the youth segment, a lot of people are going to think, well, this is a lot safer than smoking cigarettes. It's not, but the perception is out there that it is a lot safer.
The study also showed a majority of the ads said Juul's help users stop smoking. And according to the CDC, 7 out of 10 youth have seen ads for e-cigarettes or Juul's.
One of the issues was that it was marketed to this younger population, the flavors that they had used. So they'd used a lot of fruit-based flavors, and they had used a lot of flavors that they felt the youth market would enjoy.
The Truth Initiative reports that 43% of youth started vaping because of the appealing vapors that are advertised to them.
A Juul is like a vape. It fits in your pocket. It's like people use it, you know, a lot. Supposed to be used, intended for, like, you know, people trying to quit smoking cigarettes.
That's Will, a Mount Pleasant student who says he has been Juuling for a few months. He says he can already feel the addictive effects of the nicotine.
I did do it because I thought it was cool, but now I just do it because I have to.
And Juuls have become common in schools like Mount Pleasant. Because they do not produce a strong odor, they are small and look like a flash drive, and the smoke dissipates quickly, it is almost too easy to sneak them into schools and smoke them without teachers noticing.
With Juuling, it's like you could just go in the bathroom, go in the stall, and a couple puffs might go up, but like no one's really going to notice it.
Will estimates that roughly half of the kids at Mount have Juuls.
I'm pretty sure like you could walk down the hallway, and there will be 30 kids in front of you. 15 of them will probably have a Juul, bro. At least half of them.
In regards to the prevalence of Juuls among students, Dr. Felizzi said this.
Yeah, it's very prevalent. Juuls were introduced in 2015, and as of this fall, something like 36 million middle and high school students vape. Now, having done research, I would suggest that that's probably an underreported figure. I'll bet there's a lot more out there. So I would probably say that number could even be higher.
It's worse than cell phones. When you have to put up no vaping signs in the bathroom at school, you know there's a problem that needs to be taken care of ASAP.
Because of Juul's small size, students are able to bring it into schools almost undetected. Pair this with the quickly dissipating vapor, and students can be Juuling, leaving everyone else none the wiser.
You know, I'm sure there are people in school today who could be vaping in class, and the teacher's not able to pick up on it.
The KBG at Mount Pleasant has historically worked to fight cigarette use among students. But last year, the group started focusing on Juuls. Why the transition? Because cigarettes in youth and adults alike simply isn't as prevalent as it used to be, in large part due to education.
Smoking cigarettes now is not socially acceptable in any public place. And that took years of education. And I believe that's what you have to do in this case. I think people have to be educated about the addictive properties and the danger that vaping pure nicotine can cause, not only the human body, but the human brain.
Some anti-Juul advertisements have begun circulating with hopes of reaching a teen audience and informing them about the dangers of Juuling, while the FDA has begun banning Juul flavors in an effort to reduce the appeal to youth. But is it enough? What other factors about Juuls are harmful that the FDA may not be aware of or controlling?
As a matter of fact, Juuls in this country have a higher rate of nicotine, higher concentration of nicotine than any other country.
One of the reasons behind this lack of regulations is that Juuling is new, and it's something that the government did not expect to be so popular.
This caught the government by surprise. I don't think that they thought that this was going to be as prevalent or as popular as it is. And I think it really, the FDA even admitted it caught them by surprise.
E-cigarettes are new, and people are uninformed. And as time goes on, more and more information, such as this piece, will circulate and hopefully raise awareness to the dangerous aspect of Juuling.
So people say to me, is tobacco addiction really something? Is nicotine addiction really? Yes, there is a tobacco use disorder, and it's characterized by folks who technically become addicted to nicotine.
Even Juul Labs warns on its website, if you don't smoke or vape, don't start.
Thanks to Junior Sean Coulter for his piece. Next, we hear from Senior Jada Thomas. She looked into the uncertain times faced by so-called dreamers, young people who were not born in the U.S. but brought here as children. She found some dreamers locally are watching the status of the Federal Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, very closely.
I was born and raised in Venezuela. It is going through its worst time in history. If I can give you an idea, it's kind of like you go to a supermarket and you're not going to find anything to eat. People are starving. People are dying. If you don't agree with the government and what they're doing, they will just kill you.
Valentina Maza is a senior at William Penn High School. She came to the United States in 2016 when she was only 14, leaving both of her parents behind in her home country. Valentina arrived in the United States too late to qualify for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. Valentina is currently applying to college. She dreams of studying political science and one day becoming a politician. But in the meantime, she worries her immigration status could hurt her chances of being accepted or her ability to pay for college.
There are many colleges that will not offer financial aid because they only receive federal funding.
Mount Pleasant counselor Iman Turner works with students of many different immigration statuses. He says students in programs like DACA can sometimes access funding.
Well, there were certain students, certain schools, that if the student was in what they referenced as the citizenship process, if you could prove you were in the process, then like Delaware Technical Community College would give you the SEED scholarship because you would say, all right, I've taken step one or two of the Dreamer Act to establish a permanent residency. But now it's like everyone is illegal.
Back in September of 2017, the news circulating around about DACA being rescinded came as a tragedy to many. Our nation erupted in protest, with DACA students demanding some type of action to be taken. In early 2018, a federal judge decided to halt the Trump administration's actions, buying some time for the program. This seemed like a win for some, but others were left out, as the program is no longer taking new applications. As of early 2019, the Supreme Court denied Trump's request to fast-track a decision on whether or not DACA shall remain.
The students don't have a pathway to citizenship right now, so it was always difficult. But now I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel any longer.
But Mr. Turner believes that no matter a student's immigration status, they deserve a right to education.
At the end of the day, if students were brought here illegally, they didn't have any control over that. And again, we want to have a great society, so we're going to do a great job educating that student.
Valentina's thoughts are similar.
As an immigrant, I can tell you that we come here because we are running away. We're running away off a really painful situation in our countries. And we're just trying to find a better life in the land that promises freedom. In my personal experience, freedom does not exist in Venezuela.
In the future, Valentina hopes to start her own nonprofit here in the U.S. to help spread the importance of education for immigrants like herself. She also hopes to make change in her home country, Venezuela.
Where I see myself in 10, well, not 10, like 20, 30 years is being in my country, helping my people and fix all the reasons that made us leave. And also giving back to the country that gave me so many opportunities, which is the United States.
Thanks to Senior Jada Thomas for her piece. And a reminder that these pieces are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH. A reminder that these pieces are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH. And the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us and worked on these pieces with teacher Paul Wishengrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, Mount Pleasant High School students Sean Coulter and Jada Thomas, and Delaware Public Media's Sarah Mueller and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.